This is Steve Sherlock with another series of podcasts for Franklin Matters. This is a special two-parter. I managed to sit with Scott Mason recently on the town common, and we spent about 50 minutes running through a gamut of the issues surrounding the special election, the override vote coming up on June 8th. I've split it into two parts, so it'll be 69A and 69B for just the simplicity of listening. You'll have about 25 minutes in each part. The conversation does continue from one to the other, but there is a relatively natural break in the middle. And I think the conversation should be enlightening. There's a number of facts, a number of rationales behind it that are discussed and reviewed as we cover, again, the whole gamut of issues. So this is part one. Part two will follow. There will be show notes that will have some key quotes and, of course, links to supporting documents. Sitting here with Scott Mason on the town common, so if you get a little background noise, we're out in the open, clearly helping the transparency of some of the discussions and some of the issues we're here. Thank you for spending some time today, Scott. I know we last talked in the fall in preparation for the town election. We've got a special election coming up on June 8th. And I know you've been spending a lot of time on the informational meetings. What are you hearing? What are some of the issues coming up there?
First of all, thank you, Steve, for talking to me. This is a very busy time for us. As you know, and I'm sure as most of the listeners know, we have a ballot question on June 8th that will ask the citizens to vote for an additional $3 million on their taxes. And not their individual taxes, but in the town taxes as a whole. And so it is a busy time for us. We're spending a lot of time going around educating folks to what this means, both if it passes and if it fails to the town, and what the short-term and long-term ramifications are. It's kind of interesting that here we are outside, enjoying a beautiful day, but also we commented on the lawnmower going around. We're very fortunate to have a tremendous level of service here in Franklin. The Common is in beautiful shape this early in the year, so yeah. A sign of our tax dollars at work. As far as what I'm hearing, it's kind of the same each year. We have an override. There's unfortunately a percentage of the people that are only peripherally aware, if at all, that there's even an override on the ballot, and that some of them are not sure what the issues are. There's always some people that, no matter what, they just don't want to pay more taxes. So it doesn't matter what we ask for; they're just not interested. And then there are fortunately a considerable number of people that are very interested in the issues, and have been very receptive to the information that we've been trying to provide them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, for sure. Because there's certainly a lot of information. I know we had done the override in 2007, that had passed. That was the first one. 2008, that failed. And one of the feedback pieces there was primarily we didn't have a long-term plan. The plan is now out. It's been updated. You're actually participating now on that committee that did the update in 2010. So hopefully that'll help to create some information for the folks to refer to.
That's right, Steve. Last year, the former council chairman, Chris Feely, created a long-range financial planning committee, and it's comprised of citizens, town councilors, finance committee members, and school committee members. And the goal of the long-range financial planning committee was to kind of look in the crystal ball and develop a five-year outlook for the town. And it showed a couple of things. One, that we clearly have an over-reliance on state aid, which unfortunately is dwindling for us, and that we're a pretty well-run community. But the underlying, message of this report is that, we need to do something in order to raise our tax base a little, or we're going to be in this same situation year in and year out.
Mm-hmm.
And there are a couple of ways to raise the tax base. One is by attracting more commercial growth to the town, which is something that we're pursuing. And the other is by raising taxes, simply.
Right.
And, that's what we're attempting to do with this question on June 8th.
Right. And the Prop 2.5, that specifically gives the voters the choice in terms of, do we want this particular level of service, or are we going to settle with lesser service?
Local government is one of the only places where you get to decide your own fate, if you will. When you pay your federal taxes, Lord only knows where they go. To the same degree, same thing with your state taxes. Your local taxes, you not only know how they're being used, but you can, if you really want to go to the trouble, you can account for them. So this is an opportunity to invest in Franklin, keep the money in town, and see a benefit for that investment.
Hmm. And in terms of some of the efficiencies in town, I think the various presentations from the police, the fire, the school, they've all been creative in trying to do more with less, but there comes a point where you simply need more.
Yeah.
Can you talk to that a little bit?
Yeah, we haven't had a choice. We've had to be creative with less because every year we've made cuts. And I think a lot of people don't realize that. I hear, unfortunately, one of the messages that I hear all too frequently is that we're poorly managed and we waste money, and that couldn't be further from the truth, and I defy anybody who listens to this to show me otherwise. I've been on the council for 5 years. I have no axe to grind. I'm a volunteer, and if there were waste, I would know about it, and it would be my job as a council to step up and do something about it, and I surely would. What this report showed, and a subsequent report that had been done a few years back by Council Vice Chairman Steve Whalen, shows that we get a lot of bang for the buck here in Franklin. We have, as I mentioned, we've cut every year. For instance, over the past 5 years, we've lost 100 teaching positions in town. Over the past 10 years, we've lost 50 municipal positions in town. Yet our population, and especially our school-age population, has increased substantially. We have over 1,000 students new in the system over that five-year period. 80% of the school budget is tied up in salaries. And if we're losing 100 teachers over that five-year time period, you'd be hard-pressed to show me where the waste is there.
Yeah.
It really doesn't exist. DPW, we haven't hired any additional employees in over 25 years. When people retire from the DPW or they move on to other jobs, we don't fill those positions. The only positions we've filled have been a couple of management positions. So we've got, we've got the same number of DPW workers as we had in the mid-80s, but right now we've got over 200 miles of roads in town.
Right.
I spoke to a gentleman Saturday who said to me, you know, you've got to do something about the DPW. This past winter, it took a lot longer to get my street plowed. And I said, it has nothing to do with the DPW. It has to do with the amount of personnel they have
right. And
the amount of work they have to do. It just takes longer now.
Yeah.
So that's a prime example.
Yeah, especially in snow when you want to have it addressed quickly.
Right.
If you don't have enough resources to cover the entire town, and the town, as you've mentioned, with more roads, we need a little bit more of a spread, and we don't have it. So.
Well, it's interesting to note that as a parent of a school-age child in the system, I've noticed over the past couple of years how much quicker the school administration is to pull the plug on school on a snow day.
Right.
And that has to do with the time they know it's going to take to clear the streets and the parking lot. It takes longer now.
Yeah.
And if the roads and parking lots aren't clear and safe, they can't have school.
Right. Because they're clearly charted with providing a safe education.
Absolutely.
A safe environment for education, and the environment is access to the schools getting to them.
Absolutely it is.
Yeah. Yeah. Another topic along DPW and their trucks seem to be new, and yet from the records, they're not new. They're just, you know, repaints and taken care of. But
you know, it's I filed this one under rumor du jour, and as council chairman, I guess this stuff hits me first and probably Jeff Nutting first. But it seemed like I spent an inordinate amount of time over the past week and a half to 2 weeks dispelling this rumor that's going around that everybody in the DPW got new trucks, and it's just not true. I was the chairman of the Capital Improvement Subcommittee before the elections in November, and in my 4 years in that position, I don't ever remember recommending a new truck be purchased. There have been used vehicles mm-hmm. that have been bought during that time,
right.
and the DPW director is driving around in a used vehicle. But I'll say this, Steve. I was down at the DPW shed a couple of Saturdays ago for the Touch a Truck event.
For the open house, yeah.
And I was amazed at the condition of these vehicles and how well kept they are. Yeah. I can understand how people would think they're new. They, you know, they're shiny.
Yeah.
Clearly, these people have a lot of pride in their equipment and their jobs in order to keep them in that condition.
Yeah.
And I'm sure part of that stems from the fact that they know they're not going to get new vehicles.
Right.
So they better take care of them.
Right. Yeah, I was there as well, and there's some pictures on Franklin Matters in the Post where there was two pieces of equipment, one 3 years, one 16 years. You really couldn't tell the difference just looking at them. And then the bucket truck that I know had been some conversation around at the purchase, initially was going to be like 130 or something, 1,000, brand new. We ended up getting it for less than 50,000, if I remember.
It was less than 50.
And
in fact,
came,
I think it was 30.
Yeah, and it came with a paint job, which is why it looks new.
Right.
But,
right.
Yeah.
You know, I give a lot of credit to Jeff Nutting for continually not only searching for new efficiencies, but stretching dollars.
Mm-hmm.
I've never seen anybody stretch budgets like he can.
Right.
But unfortunately, we're at a point where we can't stretch anymore.
Right.
We're about to break.
Yeah. And on the police side, the passage of the override would restore or at least maintain the three dispatchers. Can you talk to that? Because one of the issues there might be a recording.
I do, but first I just want to say that all of the issues involved with the overrider are simply to keep level services. We're not looking to increase positions.
Right.
We just don't want to lose any more. And even having said that, this budget this year, even with the override, doesn't maintain all of the positions. There are a few town positions that we're going to get rid of. Because we still feel like it'll create some efficiencies for us. But as far as the police go, there probably can't be a more perfect example. There was a stat sheet that was comprised by the chief, and I'm sure Gary McHarriher and the fire department keep similar statistics. But this was very eye-opening in that, over the past 10 years, or let me rephrase it, in 1999 we had 46 police officers.
Correct.
In 2009, we had 46 police officers, the same number. Over that time, of the four categories that they keep statistics on, every single one of them has gone up substantially. One, I believe, was 125% that had gone up. But 911 calls, juvenile incidents, everything across the board has gone up, and we have a 20% increase in population.
Correct.
During that time.
Yeah.
So the same number of police officers are working substantially harder and dealing with more people. So, you know, the idea that, you know, once again, you know, we hear these ludicrous stories of, well, you know, I always see the policeman, you know, there's a car always parked behind some building and there's always a policeman sleeping in it. No, there isn't.
Mm-hmm.
There just isn't.
Right.
These people are held accountable. They work hard. There's too much work for them to do to be doing something like that.
Right.
I work from my home, and my home is located about halfway between the fire department and the police station, and I hear the cruisers and the ambulance up and down the roads all day long, every day.
Yeah. The incident reports, the activity logs are posted daily on the website, so the townspeople, voters, can go search for themselves and see what's out there. There's an awful lot of activity on a regular basis.
Yeah. You mentioned the dispatchers, and we're, unfortunately, if we don't pass the override, one of the losses that will occur are that of three dispatchers. And, you know, there's a lot of concerns tied with that. We get, in Franklin, because of the volume of calls, it's not uncommon that we get two calls that come in at the same time, or we get one call and then right after that another call.
Yeah.
Well, without the proper number of dispatchers on duty, what's going to happen is you're going to go into an automated queue. So if you've got someone that's laying on the floor that needs an ambulance and there's all of a sudden a wait time created because we don't have the personnel to answer that call, that I don't see how that's a good thing for this town. I talked to recently the chief of police from Holliston, and I asked him, you know, what his budget situation over there was, and he said we don't even have dispatchers. He said we have our police officers do the dispatching. And I said, okay. I said, so you know, as long as there's someone manning the dispatch, you know, what's the big deal? And he said, Scott, he said, it takes people off the street.
Right.
He said, it's the worst scenario possible. He said, you got people answering the call, but you've got no one to go out and answer it.
Right.
So it's not a good situation, and we certainly hope to avoid that.
Yeah. So we've kind of talked DPW, we've talked police, fire departments in there, libraries in there, but schools, clearly another big area. Always subject of, you know, maybe there's too many administrators, and yet the stats show otherwise.
Yeah, the Department of Elementary and Secondary Education keeps statistics on every town, and it's public information. You can go on their website, and you can see it for yourself, but basically, there are 11 categories that the state tracks as far as each town's educational spending goes. And we are below average in all 11 categories. Some of them we're substantially below. I believe the one that you just mentioned, administrators, were something like 52% below the state average in spending.
Mm-hmm.
So the argument that we're top-heavy in administrators is wrong.
Right.
That doesn't cut it. But we're looking at, you know, in terms of cuts, we will lose 15 teachers on the elementary and middle school levels. And what that means, see, there's a perfect example. There goes the police right now. What that means for parents and students is that class sizes in the elementary school level could top out at 28 and on the middle school level at 30. This poses a major, major problem for teachers because they're not able to devote the time to students who need a little more help in the classroom. Furthermore, the timeliness in grading papers and tests and getting them back to the students and providing feedback becomes much longer. In some cases, impossible. I met with a history teacher earlier this year that told me that because of her class sizes, she can no longer review homework when it's handed back. She grades it, she passes it back, and that's it. And I said to her, how does that help the students?
Yeah.
She said, it puts them on their own.
Yeah.
Not a good position to be in.
You don't get that additional feedback in terms of this is where you need to expand upon, this is where you need to develop.
There's that level of interaction goes away. Now, for the highly performing students, that's less of an issue.
Right.
But as you know, with your wife being a teacher, those are a much smaller percentage of the general body of the classroom.
Yes.
The majority of the students need that extra help.
Correct.
And they're not getting it anymore.
Right. And I think as you're aware, I know from the school committee meetings, the DESE, the MCAS reports are showing that actually the vulnerable ones, the lower economic, the special ed needs, those are the ones who are already showing decline or lack of progress in the terms of MCAS. And that's primarily because of the increases that we've already seen in the class sizes in the last couple of years.
Our most vulnerable citizens are the ones that stand to suffer the most if this override doesn't pass.
Right.
And that's the unfortunate aspect of it. I've heard quite a bit in going around this year, well, you know, why is it you always pick on the school department? You know, how is it that they always get hit for cuts? And the unfortunate reality of that is that they account for 52% of our annual operating budget. They're the biggest entity, so they've got the biggest target on their back.
Mm-hmm.
And we don't want to cut any place if we don't have to. But if we have to cut any place, we have to do so first and foremost in a place where there are the most people, and they have the best chance of maybe absorbing some of that.
Right.
Now, in years gone by, I think some of that absorption was accomplished. It doesn't work anymore.
Right.
We're well beyond that.
Yeah.
The effects of any further cuts are going to be drastically felt.
Yeah. Yeah, I think further to the argument that 80% of the budget is teachers is because the field trips that used to get planned for, the textbooks that used to get purchased, the supplies, I mean, either they're providing by PCCs and other individual efforts, I mean, the town's no longer providing those.
Right, right. And you know, the textbook thing is a perfect example of how absurd we've had to get in dealing with our operating budget. There is no operating budget line item for textbooks within the school system. If the schools want books, they have to come to the town council, and we have to make a capital appropriation for them to do that.
Right.
That's crazy. And I said to someone the other night, I was speaking to a group, and I said, you know, I said, the last time they came in front of us, they were replacing textbooks that were used when I was in school almost 30 years ago. So, you know, not only were they outdated, but they had to come to us on their hands and knees because they have no money of their own to do it.
Right.
It's a pretty sad state of affairs when it gets to that point.
Yeah.
Just keeping in the theme of the schools, teacher cuts aren't the only place where the pain will be felt. Athletic fees are going to go up across the board on the high school level, as are extracurricular fees. Extracurricular fees are going to go from $25 to $50 per child per activity. Athletic fees are going to, which are $125 across the board now, are going to go from $175, and they're going to be tiered to up to $450 for hockey players, track athletes, because they require the least amount of capital expenditure, budgetary expenditure, will pay $175. I believe everybody else is in the neighborhood of $225 to $250.
Right.
And then, like I say,
hockey is
$450.
Yeah.
So, I mean, it's drastic. You know, Jeff Roy had mentioned that, you know, we're in the business of providing a free education, but it's no longer... It's not a free education anymore.
Yeah.
Every time you turn around, you're putting your hand in your pocket for something. And to me, that's not right.
Yeah. Clearly, there's an incentive for at least all the parents that have school-aged children, if you consider the increases in the fees versus the increase... I thought he was going to come close, but I guess he is.
Once again, folks, your tax dollars at work.
Harder work. So on the fees for the parents with school-age children, I think if they started to do the math to have the additional fees for the additional sports, it would actually be a cost savings for them to just have the one, quote, override amount for their property taxes.
Yeah. A gentleman the other night was arguing against the override, and I asked him if he had school-age children. He said, yeah, I have a son who's going to be a senior next year. And I said, does he play sports? He said, he's a hockey player. And I said, it's cheaper for you to vote yes. I said, because it's going to cost you $450 if it fails. And he thought about it for about 2 seconds, and he said, you're absolutely right. He said, all other issues aside, he said, just from a pure economic standpoint,
pure
it's cheaper for me.
Right.
So, and then there are some other issues related to the schools, some cost-saving measures. We're going to eliminate 3 buses, which means longer routes and longer travel times for the students.
Higher capacity in the buses.
Higher capacities in the buses. We're going to truncate the school day for elementary school students on Fridays by an hour and a half. We will be eliminating the, I believe they're called activity assistants.
Activity monitors.
Activity monitors, thank you.
Yeah.
And by doing that, it will save teaching positions. But what it means is that teachers will use that time in curriculum preparation. And... So the students will be home an hour and a half earlier. It's been a general philosophy around the world these days that the school day is lengthened, not shortened. Here we are in Franklin shortening the school day.
Right. Yeah.
So it's not a good scenario.
No. And as Maureen Sebelinski, the superintendent, said, you know, it's given the poor choices, it was the better of the two, but it's still not a good choice.
Well, there are no good choices at this point. Yeah. Everything we do hurts badly, and... There are some things that they took off the table that unfortunately they're going to be taking a look at next year. And if an override doesn't pass, and I, you know, it sounds threatening or it sounds like a scare tactic when I say it like that, but the hard reality of it is if the override doesn't pass this year, you know, they're going to be looking long and hard at full day kindergarten,
mm-hmm.
moving to a half day kindergarten. There's going to be, you know, obviously more teacher layoffs.
Right.
There may be a loss of athletics completely. That was a discussion that was held briefly this year.
Yeah.
Mendon and Upton, which comprise the Nipmuc Regional School District, Mendon just failed an override. If Upton, if the other half of that, Upton fails, they're going to lose their athletics.
Right.
I mean, I can't even imagine a high school sports tradition as strong as Franklin's, and we have to cut athletics.
Right. So while we've talked about clearly the issues and the impacts on the negative side if it fails. The alternative is for us to make the choice to increase taxes on our own property to provide the funds for the level services. Longer term, there may still be an opportunity for additional override proposals. This is not the silver bullet. This is not the last one.
No, in fact, Judy Pfeffer referred to it as a Band-Aid. I think maybe with a touch of sarcasm, but the truth of the matter is it is a Band-Aid, and we know it's a Band-Aid. The $3 million override this year is meant for nothing more than level services. We're not, like I said before, we're not looking to add anything, but it's not going to do anything to help us next year. We anticipate that next year we could be as much as $6.8 million in deficit. So, you know, it's quite possible we could be coming back to the voters again next year. Needham, for an example, has passed 47 overrides out of 50 in 30 years. And some of those aren't big overrides. Some of them are 50,000, 100,000. But the voters are conditioned to know that when the money is needed, they're going to be asked to vote on it. And I think that's the situation that Franklin voters need to accept at this point. They're always going to have the opportunity to have their own say, which is something that Proposition 2.5 has created.
Right.
And to me, that's wonderful. But at the end of the day, they're going to decide what type of town they want to live in.
The music intro and exit, as usual, is from Michael Clark and the group East of Shirley. The piece is called Ernesto Mañana, copyright Michael Clark and Tintype Tunes in 2008, and used with their permission. I hope you enjoy.